listening to CPR, communitypublicradio.org. And this is Weekday World. I'm your host, Don DeBar. With a report of some of the news and events of the past 24 hours from the CPR Newsroom. From Community Public Radio, this is the CPR News. From New York, I'm Don DeBar.
بيان صادر عن القيادة العامة للجيش والقوات المسلحة.
That was Ali Abdullah Ayyub, the chief of the general staff of the Syrian Arab Army, announcing that Syria's military had, quote, completed its mission in restoring security and stability to the city of Deir ez-Zor entirely, closed quote. He made the announcement on television in Damascus on Friday. That city, at a key crossroad between Damascus and Baghdad, had been under siege since 2011. For more on what that means, we spoke with Mark Sloboda, senior lecturer in international affairs at Moscow State University, from Moscow via Skype on Friday. Okay, Mark, so it looks like this Syria thing is wrapping up pretty quick all of a sudden. Now we got Deir ez-Zor.
I think wrapping up when we're talking about Syria is a little bit early and triumphalist. Yeah. We still got the I mean, ISIS has been on the ropes for a long time, and it's been about a race for territory. But this U.S. and their SDF proxies and Al Qaeda still in, you know, in the east. This race for territory and this tense situation out there with hinting at partition. The Al Qaeda firmly in control of Idlib province now. Cooperating with the Turkish military on, you know, in Al Qaeda held territory, Turkey controlling a huge swath as well, plus you know, dug in rebel redoubts in East Ghouta and Dara. This is still a long way, but certainly ISIS is on the ropes in East Syria. Deir ez-Zor, you know, this is a significant city because this was Syria's lifeline to hold on to the whole eastern part of the country. There were some 5,000 to 7,000 Syrian men, the majority. About 2,000 of them were regular military, and the other 5,000 were police and basically draftees.
Right.
They withheld this city for 5 years of siege.
Wow.
5 years. 2 years from Al-Qaeda, which was the predecessor in the region to ISIS, and then 3 years from ISIS, and it was just Deir ez-Zor in a sea of black, of ISIS-held territory. Daily attacks on the city. It was kept alive via airdrop. The Syrian and Russian militaries kept it supplied. They held out there for 5 long, terrible years, protecting some over 100,000 civilians. And of course, how many of them would have died if ISIS had, managed to seize the city. And not only that, but on at least 3 occasions, troops defending Deir ez-Zor came under fire from U.S. and its so-called coalition aircraft, usually either directly before or during ISIS attacks. And the U.S. really wanted Deir ez-Zor to fall, because if Deir ez-Zor fell, then they could take it over, either with some kind of they hoped with some kind of cobbled together Arab force that they never managed to Sunni Arab force that they never managed to manufacture. They had a big problem manufacturing those moderate rebels,
right?
Or with the SDF, the Kurdish majority forces. They hoped that Deir ez-Zor would fall to ISIS, then they would be able to take it and use that, the regional capital, to partition the east of the country. But it never fell, even after this U.S. close air support for ISIS attacks. And when I say that, I'm not exaggerating. I mean, the U.S. of course always claimed it was a mistake, but this wasn't a one-off strike or anything. These were usually 45-minute, an hour-long sustained air attacks. At one point, it cost Deir ez-Zor control of the airport, of their airport, which was helping keep them alive, and it wiped out 10% of the troops that were protecting that. The U.S. was really playing a cynical game out there.
Yeah.
But 2 months ago, the Syrian army and their allies made a three-pronged attack across the Syrian desert, because this is the east of the country. It's scarcely populated, but it controls Deir ez-Zor alone controls the province, controls over half of Syria's oil. That's where it's located. They made a three-pronged assault that they eventually met 2 months ago. Penetrated the lines and were able to get resupplies into the city. They reached it, and here we are two months later from reaching the city. It has been completely cleared now of the last ISIS dug-in ISIS holdouts, and the people of the city are safe. That garrison, God bless them. They've been relieved. And most importantly, it prevented the U.S. from using Deir ez-Zor and, the oil in the province, using that capital city as a basis of partitioning the country in the east. So there's still other dangers with Raqqa and so on, but with Deir ez-Zor so close, that was a crucial city that makes it much harder for the U.S. to do that, to partition the country. So now there's one final urban holdout. This is the twin Syrian-Iraqi city of Abu Kamal on the Syrian side of the border, and Abu Qayyim Al-Qaim on the Iraqi side. There's a coordinated attack from both sides. Both the Syrian army and the Iraqi army are closing in on this dual towns, that stride the border. They're both on the south side of the Euphrates. The Iraqi forces already managed to take the border crossing, and both sides are moving into position to clear that up. And then that should clear up the last urban stronghold of ISIS, and then the caliphate as a territorial area in eastern Syria and western Iraq will come to largely to an end. Of course, ISIS will continue to exist both in Syria and Iraq. They'll fade into the desert. They'll join other groups. They'll become, a terrorist insurgency force. But they're also global now. I mean, aside from Syria and Iraq, they're in Yemen, they're in Afghanistan, they're in Libya, they're in the Philippines, they're all over the world now. Now, of course, the situation is the East is this tense territorial race and control of oil and gas fields between the U.S.-backed proxies and the Syrian government. And that's going to now come to both a strategic and a political head soon. The U.S., the Trump administration, continues publicly to claim that they support Syria's territorial integrity, and the only reason they're in Syria is to fight ISIS. Well, that rationale, that modus operandi is coming to an end. Because with ISIS losing their last urban strongholds, the U.S. is losing its pretext for being in eastern Syria. Right. And they will have to make a decision whether they're going to push the Kurds towards partition, which I feel worse about, that it would be disastrous for the Kurds after everything that they themselves have endured with ISIS and U.S.-backed Islamists, Al-Qaeda, etc. I think that the Kurds deserve something, some type of autonomy, some type of federalism, but they have to be realistic, and they can't have their expectations too inflated by the United States and risk being used as useful idiots. We saw what fate once again befell the Kurds in Iraq,
right,
with Barzani disappearing, the goal of Kurdish declared Kurdish independence evaporating very quickly. Right back, perhaps even worse than when they began a year ago. And you'd think the Kurds on both the Syrian and the Iraqi sides of the border would have learned to beware of Americans bearing gifts. we're talking already, this is the third time they've been played by the United States. So, I'm not a big supporter of the ideology of ethnic nationalism, the right. idea that every little nation on the planet deserves a state, because the creation of these ethnically pure states requires endless amounts of genocide, fratricidal warfare, ethnic cleansing, mass moves of population, because it simply doesn't occur naturally. It took hundreds of years for this to take place in Europe. We're talking huge genocidal fratricidal war, Hundred Years' War, the 80 Years' War, the Wars of Spanish Secession,
please.
World War I, World War II, the Yugoslav Wars, right up to the Ukrainian conflict, where it's, still continuing.
Right
it's,
up to Catalonia, even that,
Catalonia, like,
okay. It's insane. It's been real busy. First of all, I wanted to ask you, because we haven't had a chance to speak since this happened. The Barzani stepping aside happened within like a day, I think, or hours of the meeting in Moscow the foreign minister of Iraq and Lavrov met in Moscow. And then like within a day, Barzani's like, sayonara.
Yeah, there were two large factions of Kurds in Iraq. One of them, the controlling faction, was the Barzani clan and their political party that was affiliated with them. And then there was a separate political party, the Kurdish Democrats, as they're called, that were under the Taliban. And when it came down to the crux point, when Iraqi forces, when the referendum happened, Barzani to declare independence, and Iraqi forces went in to first Kirkuk, which was outside of what was proper considered Kurdistan, which was the internal division of the country that had been agreed when the U.S. removed Saddam Hussein's government in Iraq and pushed the country towards federalism. The Taliban, their political clan, their Peshmerga, they withdrew completely from their defensive positions, leaving Barzani's Peshmerga and his political party in a completely undefendable position.
Right. In the crosshairs, yeah, right.
Yeah, in the crosshairs. This is the PUK, the Patriotic Union of Kurdistan. And they, as a result of that, the whole thing collapsed overnight. Kirkuk fell first. The Kurds started retreating everywhere back to, again, they had seized some extra 20% over of their own territory, 20 to 50% actually. It was a large amount of territory out what was considered Kurdish territory proper. And Kirkuk was an important city for control of oil and gas fields that would have made a Kurdish state somewhat viable, but it didn't have a Kurdish majority. It doesn't have anywhere near to a Kurdish majority. There's arguments that historically it did. They were moved out. That's neither here nor there. The city was not Kurdish majority. It was not within the borders of Kurdish autonomous area. So now they risk losing everything. Barzani is disappearing, resigning in disgrace. We will see probably fresh elections that are badly needed in Iraqi Kurdistan. This independence movement in Iraq has come to a crashing end, a surprisingly devastating collapse of the whole movement and the central government in Baghdad restoring authority over the country.
Yeah, you've got some discussion going on out in the public domain now that there's some sort of a real politic acknowledgement on behalf of the Syrian government, which I actually haven't heard affirmed by them, but that they're going to have to accept some loss of territory. I believe it was in the north, and that one of the primary players up there is actually very heavily connected to BP, and that you're starting to see not just the U.S.'s hand and the local players, Turks and the Saudis, but actually that of the U.K. looking to have its interests expressed through the partitioning of northern Syria.
You're talking with the Kurds, the Kurdish area.
Yeah, exactly.
I mean, there's all kinds of talk, and of course, oil is a big concern and everything, and there is no final resolution. I don't think the Trump administration itself has made up its line, whether it's going to eventually withdraw, use the Kurds for political leverage in some kind of settlement, or push for a partition. They've muddled through, their first, not even a year yet in office. They've vastly increased military support for the Kurds, U.S. Boots on the ground. They've vastly increased all of this, but they still don't have, I think, a strategy. They are lacking both a strategy on the ground in Syria and a geopolitical strategy, because the Kurds represent a very poor partition partner because it will alienate them from both the government that they installed in Baghdad in Iraq, you know, all those years ago now in the invasion of Iraq, and from Turkey, which is a NATO partner and whose air bases are crucial to U.S. Geopolitical control or influence in the Middle East. And if Turkey further moves away from the U.S., upset about what they're doing with the Kurds in Syria and Iraq, it must be said, although the Turks have had their own game with the Barzani clan that they've lost out on. Then the U.S. really puts itself and reduces its own influence in the region. So the Kurds just do not represent a good partition partner for them. I hope that cooler Kurdish heads prevail in Afrin and elsewhere, those who aren't directly under the U.S. wing, and that some negotiation can be reached. Up till now, I think the understanding from the Russian government is that some compromise between the Kurds and Damascus would have to be reached, and that some type of federalism was Moscow's preferred pragmatic solution to this. But recently, Syrian government, with all its successes, has been pushing further to central control and restoring the entirety of the territory of the government under control of Damascus. And the rumor mill here is that Moscow at this point, because of the duplicity of the U.S. and so on, might now be willing to stop pushing the Damascus government on federalization, and they may be willing to back Damascus all the way to restoring control over the entirety of the territory. I think they expect the U.S. to fold at some point and just leave ignominiously, you know, making some kind of declaration. Trump claiming he's defeated ISIS, the rest of the world laughing, and then the U.S. forces being pulled out in the middle of the night sometime and leaving the Kurds to hang. That remains a strong possibility, but again, the writing's not on the wall, and the neocons would like to push the Trump administration in a different direction, in several different directions, actually.
Yeah, I mean, I'm looking at it, as a matter of fact, the policy that led to here wasn't Trump's. This was the Obama administration's baby, and Trump had made it clear during the campaign that the entire program of regime change was something he did not want to get involved with.
And regime change, nation building,
the whole bit. Yeah,
he specifically spoke against it. He made so many tweets over Obama's involvement Syria, the terrorist forces, When he made the strikes against Damascus on this pretext of a chemical weapon attack on Al-Qaeda at Khan Shaykhun and so on, he cost himself a lot of his support, of his own, I don't want to say his, majority Republican support, but his strong alt-right base. Maybe right. I'm not using that. All those people wouldn't correctly identify themselves as alt-right, but a lot of his political backers, active on the internet and so on, were non-interventionists.
Exactly, right? and that was a problem for them. But if you look at what has actually unfolded. Here's the shiny thing over here, which was that strike and the, Nikki Haley blathering some nonsense at the UN, etc. However, Russia is, going through their program, Iran and everyone, unimpeded. There's a whole lot of bluster coming out, but the U.S., in fact, is getting out of the way and letting this happen and playing, in reality, even by doing nothing, a constructive role while this gets cleaned up. And we just had Astana, the seventh round closed on Tuesday, and they've scheduled for the second half of December the next round. It's quite possible that there's going to be at least a, framework of a political solution coming out soon. ISIS's back has been broken, as you said, and it's really a cleanup job at this point. If the U.S. doesn't get in the way with some stupid thing to deadlock it somewhere, this could wrap up.
Okay, first of all, I'm very suspicious about the Astana process, that Erdogan still controls a large, you know, Turkey still controls a large swath of Syrian territory himself. Plus now the Astana process, this de-escalation zones declared over Idlib, which is, you know, even Western pundits, you know, that are supporting of the opposition, they admit that it's Al-Qaeda controlled. You want to call it Nusra. They currently go by Tahrir al-Sham. HTS is the acronym.
They're rebranding themselves every week almost.
Erdogan has moved military forces into Al-Qaeda-controlled Idlib in cooperation and coordination with them, actually, to try and surround the Kurdish canton of Afrin. So Erdogan, I mean... Erdogan has been in Jarablus, which is the city, the center of the territory that Turkey and its newly branded New Syrian Army proxies control. They're opening Turkish post offices, right? Like branded Turkish post offices, Turkish government. They're not planning to leave anytime soon. The Sultan still believes that territory is his, historically part of the Ottoman Empire, whatever.
Idlib is where BP, this BP person is playing, right? So that's Idlib, what's going
that makes
on.
More sense.
So you've got
that
the UK working with, you know, using Erdogan as a proxy, essentially.
That's an entirely different problem with Al-Qaeda. They are firmly entrenched in Idlib, and that is a hilly, mountainous territory with a population that a large portion of it is fairly sympathetic. Foreign Affairs just ran another whitewashing piece in just over a week, talking about the moderate face of Al-Qaeda. Once again, they're trying to... They're trying to whitewash, and rebrand Al-Qaeda as the kinder, gentler ISIS. Never mind two UN Security Council resolutions that call on member states to eradicate both ISIS and Al-Qaeda, their safe havens, and any endeavor, organization, or individual that associates with either one of them. Never mind that. Once again, we're back. All the other opposition have melted away or just, you know, become Al-Qaeda itself. They're trying to rebrand Al-Qaeda. There's some possible suggestion that Al-Qaeda could be now from Idlib redirected as a force to try to take on Hezbollah in Lebanon, which I think which would be their death now. There's still a big problem, and I don't hold much for the Astana process. But I want to point out what Trump has been up to in Syria vice what Obama was up to.
Right.
Obama was playing a two-pronged game. The Pentagon was working with the Kurds, the SDF. That's how they rebranded them. And we've had American generals openly at security forums discuss that the SDF is just their rebranding of the PKK, you know, anarcho-Marxist. I don't have a huge problem with that, right? You know, they're secular at least. But the Pentagon preferred to work with them because they were secular, the Pentagon was tasked with fighting ISIS. This is later in the conflict, of course, because earlier ISIS and Al-Qaeda were both allied with the U.S.-backed FSA. That's when they took over East Aleppo and so on. But years later, ISIS got too big for its britches, turned on the others in fights over rents and control of territory and petty political egos, and you had this fracturing between ISIS on one hand and Al-Qaeda and the FSA on the other. Meanwhile, Obama's CIA was tasked with supporting the so-called this brand, the Free Syrian Army, which wasn't free, wasn't Syrian, and wasn't really an army. They had a bunch of brigades, most of them Islamist, some of them like Al-Zinki, openly Wahhabist, and cutting the heads off of kids on videos for propaganda purposes. They were a big problem. The CIA was backing them, and I have big problems with Obama's CIA at that point. I mean, first of all, it was illegal. Secondly, they're arming, training, and paying the salaries of of sectarian militants who are allied with al-Qaeda, quite openly. Right. Everyone, you know, there's no question about it.
Right.
When Trump came in, as everything we know is that he ended the CIA support of the FSA and the other affiliated Islamist groups that were allied with al-Qaeda. And, you know, that's no small trump of change, because right. Washington Post reported a year ago that that effort alone, just the CIA to them, was at least $1 billion a year, right. taxpayer dollars a year.
That's right.
Now, what Trump did do then is vastly increase the money and the arms and giving heavy weapons, vehicular weapons and so on, tanks and then artillery pieces, and increase the U.S. Footprint, the military footprint in eastern Syria in support of the Kurds.
Right.
They rebranded it as the SDF. So Obama started this. Trump took it in a slightly different direction. And I'm happy at least that Trump stopped supporting the Islamists.
Yeah.
Because they were, you know, that's terrorism. That's state support of terrorism. There's a lot of people that don't consider the PKK terrorists. I'm kind of in the middle on that issue, but at least in Syria, they certainly haven't been. They've been fighting terrorists, but both ISIS and it must be said, the CIA's own proxies. We had Pentagon Kurds fighting CIA Islamists for sustained periods in the last few years of this war. So, you know, Trump has taken Obama's horrible, moralist strategy for regime change in Syria, and moved it in a different direction. And right. certainly the writing was already on the wall that regime change was no longer an option. But we still have Tillerson and Nikki Haley making comments like Assad's days are numbered and that he must go and so on. And you think they would have learned their lection, because the scorecards that are up on the internet of all the political leaders in the West and the GCC have at one point said Assad must go.
A million is a number too, man. You know, if his days are numbered, a million is a number too. So it doesn't mean anything.
I mean, so many of them have either been, voted out of office, removed right. from power, right. died naturally, right. and Assad is still there. You know, I'm no big particular fan of Assad, you know, the person of Bashar al-Assad. I mean, remember, I'm old enough to remember back when he was the neoliberal darling of the West.
Right, me too.
But he has held on for the last 6 years, so he deserves that at least.
Yep.
Once this is all over and elections are held, whether the Syrian people choose to continue with him or move on, that will be their decision to make. Yep. But he managed to keep the country together despite this massive Western and Gulf Cooperation Council regime change via proxy effort against him. So he deserves credit for that, at least, if nothing else.
Yep. All right, great. And we're going to have to stop there, Mark. Thank you very much. And we'll speak with you again next week and see what develops, because there's an awful lot in motion right now. Thank you.
Yeah, don't expect it to be over tomorrow. That's all I'm saying.
All right, thank you, man. Take care.
Thanks.
And that's all the news we have for you right now. For Community Public Radio, I'm Don DeBar in New York. Thanks for listening.
Hello and welcome to Crosstalk, where all things are considered. I'm Peter Lavelle. While the media and the Democrats can't get enough of Russia, 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 the Democrats' own dirty laundry is coming to light. Also, can Twitter be trusted? And has the U.S. and its allies accepted defeat in Syria? Crosstalking a rigged system. I'm joined by my guest here in Moscow, Mark Sloboda. He's an international affairs and security analyst. We also have Viktor Olevich. He is a political analyst as well as a leading expert at the Center for Actual Politics. And of course, we have Dmitry Bobich. He is a political analyst with Sputnik International. All right, gentlemen, Crosstalk rules in effect. That means you can jump in anytime you want, and I always appreciate it. We're calling this program Rigged System. we've just heard from Donna Brazile, who is acting chairperson of the Democratic Party, that indeed the Democrat primary was rigged. We all knew that, okay? And now there's a confession here. But I want to broaden out. Let me go to Dima first here. We see a rigged system in almost every single sense. And for me, it is the collapse of American soft power around the world, because the values about transparency, honesty, one man, one vote, one person, one vote, is all collapsing right in front of our eyes here. I mean, absolutely. How can you go around the world making these demands about values, Western values, when you don't adhere to them at home?
Absolutely. And I think it started a few years ago, because when people saw that Americans have a choice between Hillary Clinton and Donald Trump, the obvious question is, so this is democracy for which millions of people died in Iraq, in Libya, in Syria. That is what we are striving for. So I think it started collapsing a few years ago, but now, of course, is the peak, because actually the more this system is reproducing itself around the world, the less attractive it becomes. You know, in El País, a globalist newspaper in Spain, they started throwing accusations 2 days ago that Russia organized the Catalonian crisis. Okay. So it was not the Spanish judge who ordered 8 former members of the Catalan government.
Because there's nothing wrong with Spain's democracy.
Spain was a normal European country until some Russians got on their
network. I don't think there's anything normal in the West anymore. Victor, you know, of course we had the story about the Bernie Sanders being cheated here, but we have the same problems in the Republican Party as well. They tried to rig that one. They tried to deny a popular candidate, Donald Trump. He succeeded. Hillary Clinton didn't succeed when it was rigged here. But we have rigging. An entire political system is rigged, and we'll talk about Twitter as well. Social media plays a role in this too. Go ahead.
What happened this election cycle really shows that American democracy today is a sham. We really didn't find much new from Donna Brazile's revelations.
Right.
It was all
a confirmation. It was a confirmation.
We knew that she shared questions that CNN was going to ask during that town hall with Hillary Clinton, shared it with Clinton's campaign. We knew that the Clinton campaign used the DNC budget as its personal purse. We knew that before. Now it's just being confirmed. We also have a very interesting statement by Donna Brazile about her thinking about switching from Hillary Clinton to Joe Biden, and why she decided not to do it. It was because she thought all the women in the United States who were proud to have Hillary Clinton as the first...
Identity politics! Okay.
Right. But what does it really say? It really says that she thought, as many Democrats did, not just followers of Bernie Sanders, that Hillary was no longer a candidate, and she admits it. Who could win it? Who was likely to win at that point? She was worried about that. And even though she, as the chairman of the DNC, thought that Hillary's chances were slimmer than thought before, she was not going to exchange her for somebody else like Biden, only because somebody, you know, the women would be unhappy.
Yeah, but
the identity politics at its worst.
But a lot of people in the Democratic the Democratic Party win when they lose. Okay, we know that. Okay, that is really the what makes it really quite absurd. Go ahead, Mark.
Peter, there you go again. You and the former DNC head Donna Brazile and the ultra-progressive Senator Elizabeth Warren, you're saying exactly what Putin wants. You're casting doubt on the sanctity of the American democratic system. You're making people doubt how...
And this is why this conspiracy will never die, because it's one size fits all.
The Western
Catalonia, Donna Brazile,
the Western France, Germany,
the Clinton diehards are already out in force now denouncing Donna Brazile, the woman who herself gave Hillary Clinton the debate questions at CNN in one of the town hall forums during the election. She herself was part of this process. American democracy is doing just fine destroying itself. Thank you very much. It doesn't need any help from us pointing it out.
Coming to the studio here, you know, I watch the airwaves, and when of course there's a lot, it's very partisan. But if you look at like CNN, they still continue to defend this failed candidate. It's like a, it's like Stockholm syndrome.
It's a cult.
They can't see beyond it. I have to believe that that Donald Trump on his trip to Asia is just enjoying this, watching them continue to thrash themselves.
Absolutely. But, I mean, Hillary Clinton was not the only disappointment. You know, she disappointed the ultra-liberal elite by losing, you know. The other disappointment for normal people was Bernie Sanders, because it was shown to him now several times that the victory was stolen from him. Now Dana Brazil is confirming it, you know.
And this was before the election.
Absolutely. And still he is now talking about Russian interference, how dangerous it is. He doesn't regret urging his supporters to vote for Clinton. He is the biggest disappointment for normal people, I think,
in this situation. Bernie Sanders is somebody who wants to live his political life out in the Senate. His wife is facing some charges in Vermont with the college connected with her. And he understands very well, as politicians do, that if he would have pressed that issue with Clinton further, his problems would get worse.
He would and be so, the one blamed
exactly,
more frequently.
Exactly. So that's how the system works. Everybody who lives in Washington,
another one size that. Fits all. You know, exactly. Don't fight the Clinton machine.
Mm-hmm. Or else.
Or else.
Let's talk about the details of this, because okay. It is interesting. When Debbie Wasserman Schultz took over the DNC and we went into this election season, the Democratic National Committee, the Democratic Party, was $2 million in debt. They were still paying off the debt from Obama's victory 4 years previously and weren't expected to pay it off for another 4 years. So there was a joint fundraising agreement that was agreed between the DNC under Debbie Wasserman Schultz and the Hillary Victory Fund and the Hillary campaign.
And this is in the summer of 2015.
This was before the primary was decided. This was when Bernie Sanders was still a viable candidate. This type of taking over the DNC is normal after the primary is decided. But this happened well before that, despite what some of her diehards tried to say. And she basically used the DNC as a money laundering operation, denying money to the states, which right. We saw a lot of Democrats downhill didn't have the money they needed to fight battles. It was all sucked into this, doomed Hillary Clinton campaign. Her people were in charge of finance, in charge of all the major decisions, everything. It was a rigged process from beginning to end.
You know, one of the things, Dima, that I think is really interesting is that, you know, the left had their messiah president for 8 years, you mm-hmm. know, their messiah president. Yes. But it was he was nominally head of the party. In the 8 years that Barack Obama was in the White House, you saw over 1,000 seats, assembly members, et cetera, vanish from the Democratic Party. Have you heard one word of criticism from about Barack Obama during all of this? I haven't.
Well, I liked the expression of Dana Brazil that I did find the cancer in the center of all of this. Well, I think I also did find the cancer. You know,
she said she's not going to kill the patient.
Absolutely, yes. But Barack Obama, look at his behavior during the election. He basically destroyed the institution of elections because the main thing is neutrality of state during the election. He not only endorsed his party's candidate, he also lambasted the opposition candidate, something that had never happened in the U.S.
Very true. I mean, watching him criticizing Trump was very odd. It was something
just criticizing,
that's not exactly,
blasting
that's
him,
not exactly
calling
true.
Him a threat to mankind.
It's always been a partisan contest.
Maybe.
It's more backing your candidate, not attacking the other one.
Because
you have hacks to do that. The presidency does participate in hackery right now.
There was another very important event that happened. In May 2016, addressing the G7 publicly, Obama said that Donald Trump was not going to become the president of the United States. Who was he to promise it publicly to the leaders
of the
seven greatest
countries in the
world? All
right, before we go to the break here, I want to shift gears completely here. Again, we had the President of the United States coming out and very strongly criticizing his Attorney General, Jeff Sessions, here. That is something that is a bit unusual, okay? But I think someone has told Trump that what you can say and what you can't say, okay? But there's a lot of pressure to look at the Clintons right now. Jeff Sessions is in the crosshairs.
And this is the thing. When, you know, the Clintons were opposed to Trump before the election, they lost. They lost the election. So today, it's really not the Clintons that are driving the anti-Trump agenda today. They're against Trump, but they're not the drivers.
I think it's the media that's driving it.
Well, it's the special services and the
But
this is the interesting thing about it. The thing is that the establishment is now willing, and these revelations from Dana Brazil and the and other DNC staffers, they show that the bipartisan establishment is willing to give up the Clintons in this mess, and what they're going to do if Trump keeps on accusing Clinton of this Uranium One deal and of collaboration with Russia and so forth, what they're going to do is they're going to say, okay, you know, Donald Trump, you're right, and we are right. So both the Clintons and the Trumps we're connected to Russia, and this is all going to be used
sacrificial. Two of them.
Exactly.
All right, I'm going to jump in here, gentlemen, and we're going to go to a short break. And after that short break, we'll continue our discussion on a rigged system. Stay with RT.
You're listening to Weekday World from CPR.
Okay, let's talk about the world of Russiagate and indictments. Where do we stand, Mark?
Well, with the indictments that were issued last week, as expected, it's the indictments against Paul Manafort, Trump's former campaign advisor, and one of his aides, Robert Gates, have absolutely nothing to do with the election. They have nothing to do with Russia, and they have nothing to do with Donald Trump. These are a look into his finances. Now, whether the Mueller is trying some tactic that the FBI uses against organized crime, trying to put pressure on him on a completely unrelated, completely
to
out of the scope of the investigation, to flip him and get him to testify on something else, as presuming there's something else there. And when we get to George Papadopoulos, this poor, hapless, incompetent junior aide who obviously lied to everyone inflate his own position.
He wanted to inflate himself, and you know what, gentlemen? Yeah. He got his 15 minutes of fame.
The only thing he's been charged with is lying to the FBI about his connections with Russia, which he didn't have.
Right. You know, it was interesting. Why not Michael Flynn?
He's not forgotten.
Maybe because what Mark just said there with Manafort and Gates, there's no Russia connection here. There's more of a Ukrainian connection here. But with Flynn, it could be Turkey. Again, not Russia.
Look, the whole point of this is to force, you know, Paul Manafort is a multimillionaire who is used to a very comfortable way of life. Mm-hmm. And the last thing he wants to happen to him is for him, is to spend the rest of it in jail. No, because if he's going to be convicted on these 12 charges,
then it's a life sentence.
Even on half of these charges, it's going to be a life sentence for him. He's over 50. He's going to
close to 70.
Yes, he's not going to last 8 years.
Well, there's no guarantees that any of these charges will actually stick.
Considering what's brought against these people, what kind of force they're going to stick. If Mueller and the American establishment wants these charges to stick, they're going to stick, and Manafort knows this. So what does Mueller want this, you know, to do with this? He believes that faced with these charges, Manafort, trying to get at least some of the rest of his life,
free,
he is going to say not even necessarily what's true, but what's expected of him. And he's going to give the testimony that Mueller wants.
I don't know.
That's
Trump
the gamble.
Trump can pardon him in a heartbeat.
And if Trump...
And he can pardon himself in a heartbeat.
Well, if he pardons Manafort, it's going to be a storm in Washington. And they're going to... You see, the model with Trump being taken out of the White House, it's built. Which way it's going to happen is what we're really looking at right now. Mm. But the establishment has a model where
a frequent guest on this segment, okay? We're going to keep a track of what you're having to say because you have a pretty consistent view of what's going to happen right here.
I think Manafort, he's an establishment figure, establishment sleazeball with a capital E. He knows this way this game is played, and he saw George W. Bush pardon Scooter Libby, and you know, he was perfectly willing to chill for a few years, fight this Supreme Court and then be pardoned but with an outgoing Trump or one who wins re-election.
But he also remembers the case of G. Gordon Liddy, who unfortunately for him had to go to prison while Nixon didn't.
Well, I think, you know, with Paul Manafort, I have no sympathy for him because
he's a lobbyist. How can you have sympathy for him?
Yes. But he did not want to damage the American establishment. He worked for Viktor Yanukovych when Viktor Yanukovych was not an enemy of the United States. Just look at Obama's statements in 2009.
Who did he work for? Because the FBI says he worked for the Ukrainian president, Yulia Tymoshenko. That's Mueller's indictment. What kind of operation are they running? What kind of circus are they running there?
It was an intern from the Atlantic Council.
The Russian foreign ministry noticed this. But he was working for Yanukovych. Look at Obama's statements from 2009 about Yanukovych. At the time, the United States got disappointed with Yushchenko and Tymoshenko because they quarreled with each other. They were completely corrupt. So at the time, Obama said that maybe Yanukovych could be respecting democratic norms in the American newspeak means towing the American line.
He got a clean bill of health on his election. He got elected. And as you've pointed out on this program, the day before the coup in February 2014, all the European leaders were very friendly to Mr. Yanukovych.
Yes, and
the next day he was persona non grata.
Yes, but the point is that it was not Manafort who changed. It was the party line that changed. And the party line, by changing, you know, kind of brought disaster to Mr. Manafort. And the problem is...
Okay, but you know, I agree with you. But gentlemen, we also have... And again, it's not widely known because liberal media doesn't want to talk about it, but the connections between Podesta brothers and Manafort. I don't think Manafort is worried as you may think. I think he has if I'm going to go down, a lot of people are going to go with me, I think Washington knows that, okay? So I'm not sure your scenario is going to work out just that way.
I think that actually it's going to end that way. Yes. If we look at what's going on, basically Trump is now accusing Clinton of being a Russian agent and Podesta's brother who worked with Manafort, right? Hillary continues accusing Trump of being a British agent. You know what it reminds me of? Yezhov and Beria in Stalin's times declared millions of people being British agents, only to die being executed as British agents themselves. That's the logic of totalitarian state.
We need a new hashtag. Hashtag Je suis Russian agents. We're all Russian agents.
We can really go back to the times of Joe McCarthy. And remember how the McCarthy era ended. At some point, Mr. McCarthy, he went too far. And he started accusing parts of the army, general staff, of collaborating with the Soviets, with no evidence, of course. And one wonders where that point is going to be reached this time.
But there is a difference. That's a good point. But there is, unlike with McCarthy, as you pointed out, there is evidence. Okay, maybe we should get rid of the word collusion because collusion is not a crime, okay? Mm-hmm. But the dossier is front and center, and we need a lot more explanation about it and its ties to the Democratic Party. I mean, we started out, you know, the Democrats were in debt, $20 million?
$2 million.
$2 million. But the Democratic Party has $10 million or more to pay for a fake dossier. I think a lot of questions need to be asked. So unlike with McCarthy where it is just, you know, accusations, there's a lot of evidence to look at.
But it's not a new story. You know, the United States, if we look at recent history, the United States colluded with Saddam Hussein when he was fighting Iran and when he was using chemical weapons against Iranians. Let's not forget it. So the problem is that the United States has become a real totalitarian state, which changes its foreign policy every 10 or 15 years. And people who supported that policy 15 years ago happen to be criminals today.
Then they're thrown under the bus. I want to talk about this Twitter thing, Mark, because it's, again, this political corruption, this rigged system is creeping into the Russiagate probe in Congress. Twitter.
Yeah, so... All during these investigations, we've heard reports from all these anonymous deep state current or former officials, and the other big buzzword we've heard is Russian linked. Russian linked this, Russian linked that. What is Russian linked? Well, when the big social media and tech CEOs, Facebook, Twitter, Google, and others, came to testify before the Senate neo-McCarthyite Russiagate witch hunt trials, Twitter defined Russian linked for us.
Oh,
and I think it's important.
Pray tell, tell us all.
If you have any Russian email account, Yandex, Mail.ru, so on, so on, anything like that, you're a Russian agent. You're Russian linked. A Russian agent.
I think Tom Cruise has an account on the VK.
If you have a Russian mobile phone, you're a Kremlin agent. If you have a Russian credit card, you're a Russian agent. If you have ever once logged into social media from a Russian IP address, which means every Western journalist in Moscow and anyone who has ever visited Russia and checked their Facebook, you are a Kremlin agent. Okay. If you have Russia as your declared country, or if you use Cyrillic, which there is a lot of Russian-Americans...
I almost made
every single one.
I can add two more points. Yeah. If you, like Carter Page, met a Russian 6 months ago and failed to report it, you're a Russian agent.
To who do you report to these days?
If you said that you were going to organize a meeting with Putin's niece or Putin's nephew and didn't deliver on it, you are a Russian agent.
What other is interesting? Google. Google, which also owns YouTube, admitted that Russia broke no rules, RT, Sputnik, during its promotion of its own material.
We can't promote ourselves? Is that illegal?
What Twitter revealed is their attack on the election, because they censored the election. They identify, according to this BS criteria, as Russian-linked 2% of the activity that they highlighted during the election. But they censored, they deleted 25% of all posts with the hashtag Podesta emails and 48% of all posts with the hashtag DNC leaks.
And by the way, just yesterday, Twitter accidentally deleted Trump's account for a few seconds.
Okay. This is clear censorship during the election, hiding information that was damaging the Clinton they didn't want.
I saw a little bit of the hearings. Gentlemen, I was embarrassed. I was embarrassed for the tech giants. I was embarrassed for Congress. I mean, it was like idiots talking to fools. I mean, it's almost like, you know, Stalin, I need names.
They needed a definition. The Senate asked for a definition to define the difference between a bot and a troll, because they didn't know.
Well, one actually feels in this situation for the tech giants. It's a strange situation where you actually feel for the tech giants, because they're not the ones that are initiating it. They see the storm,
What's worrisome here is that they are going to open, they're going to allow themselves to be censored in very, very detrimental way. And you know what, gentlemen, we're rapidly running out of time. This will destroy their business model, and alternatives will come into place to replace them, because of what Dima just said there. Trusting the government. That's all that we have time for, gentlemen, here. Many thanks to my guests here in Moscow, and thanks to our viewers for watching us here at RT. See you next time, and remember, Crosstalk rules.
You're listening to Weekday World from CPR, Community Public Radio. I'm your host, Don DeBar.